the Bureau of Vital Statistics began sending rejection letters to tribal courts across the state, refusing to acknowledge tribal court adoption orders.
A long legal battle over tribal adoption is over. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 4th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, packing up a 1,500-pound iceberg in the name of science.
We were thinking of doing some ice sculpting, but we'll leave it intact. It's got a little character of its own all by itself there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
The Denali Pipeline today closed its open season offering. For the past 90 days, the company has offered space to shippers on its project that would deliver natural gas from the North Slope to North American markets. Denali President Bud Fackrell says the company has received a significant number of bids. However, they came with conditions that still need to be negotiated in private, wanting to use the line.
What we're going to try to do next is take these bids and see if you can reach binding commitments or agreements. And those will be confidential discussions over the next 2 or 3 months. The bids themselves are not what I would call bankable, that you can take to the bank and get financing. You know, we've got to convert these into binding agreements.
Fackrell says some of the conditions are out of Denali's control, but declined to confirm whether they would need intervention by the state. He said there were no surprises among the bids. The company had talked to potential shippers over the open season period and knew what to expect at closing time. Fackrell says the project is based on market conditions, and a final decision on whether to continue will come after the company and bidders determine future market conditions.
We hope to provide the shippers with a final, what we call precedent agreement, by the first of the year. And that would be something they'd have 30 days to get their board approvals on and sign. So we've got a lot of work to do over the next 2 to 3 months to be in a position to give them that precedent agreement.
Denali's competitor, TransCanada Pipeline, working with its partner Exxon, closed its open season offering at the end of July. Denali is a joint venture between BP and ConocoPhillips. The U.S. Supreme Court has denied hearing an Alaska tribal adoption case, ending a 4-year legal battle between the state and the Kaltag Tribal Council. Although the case was first litigated in 2006, the legal opinion that prompted the state's challenge dates back to 2004, when then-Attorney General Greg Renkes issued an opinion stating tribal courts did not have the authority to initiate cases, only to take them if referred from state court. Native American Rights Fund attorney Natalie Landreth argued the case for Kaltag.
And based on that opinion, the Bureau of Vital Statistics began sending rejection letters to tribal courts across the state, refusing to acknowledge tribal court adoption orders. Kaltag received one of them, and this case followed.
Landreth says the Supreme Court reaffirmed what had been decided in an older tribal court appeal, stating the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA, created concurrent but presumptively tribal jurisdiction. Landreth says there is a long tradition of tribal court authority over domestic relations of their tribal members.
The vast majority of tribal members that want to get divorced, do adoptions, guardianships, temporary custody will end up going to tribal courts first. It's not a formal right of first refusal or anything like that, so it does remain purely concurrent. But that's a recognition of the fact that most of these cases are going to run through a tribal court.
State Senior Assistant Attorney General Peter Potsier says jurisdiction over members is at the heart of why the state continued challenging the case through several appeals. Potsier says ICWA is not clear about whether tribal courts have jurisdiction over members of other tribes or non-native people.
We thought, given the prevalence of intermarriage between members of different tribes and marriages between tribal members and non-natives, and the fact that we have 229 federally recognized tribes in Alaska, we felt this was a very important issue to address.
NARF's Landreth says the end of this case does not diminish the state court concurrent authority with tribal courts, but she says tribal councils and courts are the first responders in their communities when children need protection, and it's important for the presumptively tribal aspect of ICWA to be followed. She says in the Caltag case, the council took custody and found a safe home for a child who had been living in abhorrent conditions. She says state and tribal courts can complement each other, but even after the Supreme Court's refusal to hear the state's case, there is a system-wide problem.
Until the state rescinds the October 2004 Reinke's opinion formally, that's going to remain their policy and bind all of the workers in OCS and the Bureau of Vital Statistics. The state needs to rescind that opinion and issue one that's in conformity with this decision and with the direction of the law.
Putzier wouldn't say if the state would consider rescinding the Reinke's opinion, but he says the state is developing an ICWA memorandum that would be a working agreement with tribes as a template for cooperation.
What we do want to continue to do is to work through these complicated issues with the tribes using the ICWA MOU as a template, and that would cross both the Tanana and the Caltag case, and we think that's the best way for moving forward through cooperation between the tribes and the state of Alaska.
A similar case from Tanana is currently in front of the Alaska Supreme Court. It's not yet known how that decision will impact future state and tribal court proceedings. Putzier says the D.C. law firm of Latham and Watkins worked on the state's failed Caltag appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. That case cost $105,000 to prepare. A 1,500-pound iceberg plucked from Mendenhall Lake last week is on its way to Washington, D.C. for this month's USA Science and Engineering Festival. The Juneau Economic Development Council, along with the Army's Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory, will have a booth at the event called Alaska's Cool Cryosphere. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
It's not every day that a fish plant, even one in Alaska, gets a 1,500-pound delivery of glacier ice.
That's a first. We do a lot of halibut, not quite that size. Our halibut totes weigh about 1,600 pounds, but no, that's the biggest piece of ice we've had in here.
Eric Norman is general manager of Taku Smokeries. The plant offered to help the Juneau Economic Development Council package up the iceberg and ship it to Seattle before its trip to Washington, D.C. First, they used a chainsaw to cut it down to size.
This is the first for that, too. We were thinking of doing some ice sculpting, but we'll leave it intact. It's got a little character of its own all by itself there.
Before being debulked, the iceberg measured about 7.5 feet long and 4 feet tall. A 2-foot chunk was lopped off the end so it would fit into a Taku Smokery's tote. The process of getting the iceberg into the tote may have been complicated, involving straps, a forklift, and as many as 6 Taku Smokeries employees. But JEDC Education Coordinator Mary Hakala says getting it out of Mendenhall Lake was even more arduous. Before finding this berg, they tried 2 others, one which melted overnight before they could retrieve it.
We thought we were golden and we had to go for it again. My husband kayaked out, pushed in a berg. It was too large. It grounded in 7 feet of water. He was whacking on it with our ice axe, trying to chop off chunks. So we left it there, hoping that Mother Nature would take its toll and tied it off. And this berg actually was snagged by that line as it floated by.
Taku Smokeries included the berg in a shipment to Seattle this weekend, where it will start its cross-country journey to our nation's capital in the back of a refrigerated truck. Hakala notes its journey started long before that.
It started its journey some 200 years ago as a pile of snowflakes that got formed and under pressure became these globular, beautiful ice crystals and flowed down the valley, calving into Mendenhall Lake.
While in Washington, the iceberg will be displayed alongside permafrost and tundra core samples from the interior, sea ice from the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas, and interactive displays on climate change. Scientists from the Army's Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory will be on hand to explain their research.
these are world-class scientists. It's very fun and exciting. And kids will, and families will have the chance to touch it, look at it, and also learn a little bit about the science related to glaciers and the permafrost and the warming Arctic.
HACLA and JEDC Executive Director Brian Holst will be making the trip. It's part of JEDC's Springboard program, which is funded by the U.S. Defense Department. More information on the USA Science and Engineering Expo can be found at usasciencefestival.org. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
There's some blue. There's some blue inside that. There's a blue hue in there anyway.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a life-threatening condition leads to a daring rescue near Chivac.
Even for, you know, experienced hunters, you know, try and go back in this kind of condition is almost quite impossible by it there yourself.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska's first pioneer home opened in Sitka in 1913. Continuing the tradition of loving care, five more pioneer homes opened over the years, including a veterans home in Palmer. If you are 65 years or older, need assisted living, and an Alaska resident for the past year, you can apply to live in a pioneer home. Information at 888-355-3117 or at the State of Alaska DHSS website. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Fairbanks Borough voters face two propositions on tomorrow's municipal election ballot. Proposition A would prevent the borough from banning or fining residents for using polluting heating devices. It's aimed at an air quality ordinance passed by the Assembly in June that includes nominal pollution fines and a ban on purchase and installation of non-Environmental Protection Agency approved wood stoves and boilers. The borough is trying to get into compliance with EPA fine particulate pollution regulations that are regularly violated in areas of Fairbanks during cold weather inversions. Proposition A co-sponsor and State Representative Tammy Wilson says the initiative was put on the ballot by citizens concerned about enforcement of pollution measures at a time when people are struggling to afford to heat their homes.
We live in the coldest region of the United States, and that is the way that people heat their homes and the way that they can afford to, and we just ask them to be responsible.
Last fall, borough voters supported a ballot proposition that put control of local air quality in the hands of borough government, and passage of this year's measure could result in punitive aspects of the program being handled by the state. The other proposition on ballot, borough ballots tomorrow, is familiar to local voters in Fairbanks. Prop B reaffirms the existing borough tax revenue cap. The Interior Taxpayers Association, which originally developed the tax cap and got it onto the ballot more than 20 years ago, puts it before voters every 2 years. Petersburg voters will decide tomorrow whether to prohibit smoking in most workplaces and public spaces. Opponents see the measure as an infringement on individual freedom. For supporters, the ban is about the right of employees and the public to breathe smoke-free air. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
The measure would ban smoking in bars, shops, private clubs, offices, virtually all businesses where there are employees, whether or not they're open to the public. City Councilor John Haverlick originally proposed the ordinance. He sees it as protecting the rights of non-smokers, especially workers.
60,000 people a year that are non-smokers die of secondhand smoke. And we know it causes allergies, asthma, sudden infant death syndrome. It gets involved in all of that. And I just feel sorry. You go into a bar and you see, you know, like a lot of young lady bartenders. And if they're pregnant, this is, you know, can damage their fetus. And, you know, even if they've never smoked. So there are no reasons for not having, you know, for allowing smoke, especially for innocent victims.
When a more generic version of the measure was originally introduced this spring, a handful of residents spoke out against it, but the council made several changes recommended by an ad hoc committee of smokers, non-smokers, bar owners, and other concerned residents. For instance, bars and other businesses would be allowed under this ordinance to have enclosed and well-ventilated rooms where smokers could still light up. The facilities would have to meet a series of requirements, and employees employees would not have to go inside them. The outdoor rules are a little less strict than the original ordinance. Also, the restrictions would not apply to fishing boats or other mobile marine vessels, but they would still apply to land vehicles, cars, or trucks that are used by employees. That was one of the concerns Mark Jensen had about the measure. He was one of two councillors who voted against it when it passed in June. For Jensen, it's partly an issue of personal freedom.
I agree with the health hazards of smoking. I smoked for years, and I'm glad I could quit. But it's just too restrictive, I think. One where place in the ordinance that talks about vehicles and you can't smoke in business vehicles. I tried to get that out of the ordinance, but it wasn't agreeable to the majority of the council.
Since the city council in Petersburg agreed to put the measure on the ballot, there's been little to no public campaigning from either side. During a call-in forum last week, KFSK Radio heard from a handful of supporters and opponents. One caller, Jamie Plinicky, said she was not just against the ban because she was a smoker.
It's mostly the freedom aspect of it, and also the socializing. In the wintertime, am I expected to sit at home alone when I'd rather be socializing with my friends comfortably? With respect in regards to their rights also.
Plinicky said Petersburg should leave it up to individual businesses to decide whether or not to allow smoking in public. A caller who supported the ban said she was tired of having to walk through a haze of smoke on the sidewalk.
It takes away our freedom of breathing clean air, a basic right that I think we should all have when we're walking in our own town. If people need to smoke, they should just do it in the privacy of their own home.
The ordinance bans smoking within 5 feet of outside entrances, working windows, and ventilation systems, as well as a variety of other outdoor settings. However, it does not ban smoking on public sidewalks in general. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Matanuska Susitna Borough voters will decide for or against a new form of government when they go to the polls tomorrow. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, some seasoned Valley lawmakers say the borough's ballot Proposition 1 is not a good idea.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough has what is known as a weak mayor form of government. A hired borough manager takes care of the day-to-day running of borough affairs, and that manager answers to the borough assembly. Now some on the borough assembly want to make the mayor the chief administrator and give him or her the powers and duties of the borough manager. The question is Proposition 1 on the borough ballot.
It's the last thing we need. If you're feeling that you can't afford more taxes or the economic future is a little uncertain, we certainly don't need to add another layer of government.
That's current Borough Assemblywoman Lynn Woods. Although the ballot proposition is worded simply, shall the manager plan of government for the Matanuska Susitna Borough be repealed? Woods brings up a few points that are hovering in the background.
And right now, our mayor doesn't receive a six-figure salary, and I'm sure if his responsibilities expand, that's exactly what we're going to do. And I just think we should stick with our less government and keep our taxes low. So I'm voting no on Prop 1.
Some borough candidates are direct in their viewpoint of the ballot question. Borough Assemblyman Pete Houston voted against putting the proposition on the ballot at all.
It's a pretty complicated issue, and I wanted to see more public support behind it before it came forward.
Houston says the simplicity of the question is misleading.
Primarily, I think it'll be expensive, very expensive, and very little will change. The impetus for doing it is people's belief that they'll have more control over who's running the government. The mayor, who's an elected official, then would be in charge of everything. But I think that that's not accurate.
Houston says a hired manager can be fired at any time if performance is not adequate, but a strong mayor can only be ousted through an election every 3 years. Also, Houston says a strong mayor would appoint department heads, leading to staff turnover every 3 years. Other candidates currently seeking office say the jury's still out. Warren Keough.
What I'm hearing from people are of a variety of opinions and a lot of questions about it. And I think there's a greater potential for things to become more politicized than perhaps they already are when the mayor picks a manager. And the manager owes his allegiance to the mayor, of course.
James Tapley says a hired manager answers to the assembly, but an elected borough manager would answer to the voters.
I see Anchorage. They got a strong mayor, and I see so much squabbling going on. Anyway, I like to have both positions voted on.
and Noel Woods.
Where I'm standing is listening to the comments being made on both sides and kind of waiting for everybody else to see what the answer is going to be on that one.
Mark Ewing, the assemblyman who sponsored the resolution placing the question on the ballot, would not return phone calls for this story. Borough Assemblyman Pete Houston and Jim Culver voted against Ewing's legislation at the assembly level. If passed, the Borough Assembly will be required to discuss compensation for the new position. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu.
A ballot initiative that would allow city workers to unionize has made Kodiak a political battleground between a pair of unions and the city government. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
This month has been somewhat of an air war on commercial radio, with competing ads run by the city of Kodiak and two unions looking to organize the city's workforce.
The city of Kodiak is spending $90,000 of your taxpayer dollars to defeat Prop 1, which was sponsored.
The city leadership of Kodiak is not anti-union. We're pro-Kodiak. Keep it local. Vote no on 1. Paid for by the city of Kodiak, 710 Milbay Road, Kodiak.
Paid for by the PSE.
It's a repeat of last year's referendum, which failed by 17 votes. During that campaign, City Manager Amy Kenyajowski said the City Council didn't want the tone to be confrontational.
They did not want it to become real pointed. So the ads, the quality of the ads, the tone of the ads was a little bit different last year based on council direction.
But this year's ads are more aggressive, with the unions accusing the city of wasting taxpayer money and the city accusing the two unions of outside meddling.
It's aggressive, and in other campaigns, one of the issues that pops out is that there's outsiders doing this, which is completely untrue.
That's Jake Metcalf, executive director of the Public Safety Employees Association, one of the two unions involved.
We came in because the city police wanted us to represent them. The city police put the petition on the ballot. They're the ones that will be represented and negotiate the contract.
The city approved $50,000 this year to contract with a public relations firm. Kenyajowski said to date, the city spent about $16,000 on advertising on KVOK, the Kodiak Daily Mirror, and GCI's local access channel. Both sides portray themselves as the underdog. Kenyajowski says she understands public concern over the campaign, but the city feels it's doing the right thing. The city had spent about $40,000 to defeat last year's ballot measure, leading many to decry the $90,000 allocated in 2 years on the public campaigns.
State statutes allow any municipal government to respond to a voter initiative to inform the public. I'm hoping that it will make people realize what's at stake.
Metcalf says he's surprised by the aggressiveness of the city council's campaign compared to other cities in Alaska.
My experience is when there's a ballot proposition, the council doesn't take a position. Usually they educate, which is to put a voter pamphlet out or to show through studies and that sort of thing what it may cost. That hasn't been the case here. It's just been an appropriation for advertising.
Which side will prevail won't be decided until city voters go to the polls next Tuesday.
We need to support
in Kodiak,
community.
I'm Jacob Resnick.
A simple nosebleed became a life-threatening condition for a Chivac man on a moose hunting trip last week on a small river near the Bering Sea coast. The man's nose wouldn't stop bleeding for more than 24 hours, and getting him to medical care was not easy. From member station KYUK, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
The area where Blaise Acheron was hunting is a common place for moose hunters on the lower Yukon, but it's not an easy place to travel. Luckily, his hunting partner Andrew Paniak had a VHF radio and was able to contact the nearest health clinic in Mountain Village. Mountain Village was then able to contact Bethel troopers.
He was still bleeding really bad through the nose and out, in his mouth, and then he was hypothermic.
Sergeant Teague Widmeyer helped coordinate the rescue from Bethel. He had the exact coordinates from the hunting party. The problem was it was after midnight and no one was able to respond in the dark by air from Bethel nor on the ground from Chivac. From the village, it was a 6-hour boat ride in high winds and tricky waters. Widmeyer sought other help for the next day. He tried the National Guard's helicopter, but it wasn't available, so he checked with the trooper's wildlife enforcement team, who are known as brown shirts. One wildlife trooper was available, Michael Cresswell.
It's a pretty routine situation for me to encounter hunters in the field in fairly remote places.
Meanwhile, the medical advice to the hunting party through VHF was to get back to the village if they could. So Paniak pointed the boat downriver to Chivak to try to save his friend, again, Earl Achak of the village.
Even for, you know, experienced hunters, you know, try and go back in this kind of condition is almost quite impossible by yourself. Because, you know, in that lake, sometimes the waves are huge and it's really shallow. So the obstacles were many for that guy just to come back to Chivak just like that.
Their boat ended up getting stuck in a large, shallow lake that's about 3 miles across and 2 to 3 miles wide.
It was alarming for me because it made my landing approach, even the possibility of my landing there, more complicated.
What helped him decide it was safe to land was seeing Paniak stick an oar in the water, which helped Cresswell read the depth from the air.
Looked to me like the oar was going at least 3/4 of the way down before it, you know, bottomed out.
After landing, he was able to taxi the plane to about 25 yards offshore. The water there was just below his knees. Acharin was still bleeding and was hypothermic. Cresswell was carrying along medication for him that he picked up from the Bethel emergency room before he left. After that was administered, the bleeding subsided somewhat. Getting off the lake was another story with another person on board. Cresswell had to make several attempts, but eventually found enough water in the lake to get on step. He flew Acharin to the nearest subregional clinic in St. Mary's, where they were met by EMTs. Acharin was later brought to the Bethel Hospital for further treatment. As humble as Cresswell is about the rescue, people in Chivak are forever grateful.
He is the man. Cresswell is the man who got him out.
Chivak Search and Rescue was able to rescue Acharin's hunting partner, who could not make it back to the village alone. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. October 5th is REAACRSA Election Day, and polls are open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, go to elections.alaska.gov or call 1-888-383-8683. And when you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. And if you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.